You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Why can't you just believe in me? Not everyone is the enemy. I'm trying hard, I swear I am. I'm doing the best I can. But I'm broken.
Now, folks, Shelley Wright is about to join us here on The Drew Marshall Show. Her book, Like Me, and CD Lifted Off the Ground came out in 2010. And so did Shelley. With a number one country song under her belt, single white female, and having been named Academy of Country Music New Artist of the Year, Shelley also became the first major country artist ever to go public about her same-gender attraction. She discussed it all on Oprah, but today we're going to ask her about her journey navigating some of the toughest waters in her life, especially as it pertains to Christianity and homosexuality, a subject that I get a headache every time I talk about. Award-winning country recording artist Shelley Wright joins us here on the Drew Marshall Show. Shelley, I'm so sorry for having you on hold for so long.
That's okay. I have an unlimited plan with AT&T.
Yeehaw.
All good.
Yeehaw, that's good. Ladies and gentlemen, the president of her high school band class, Shelley Wright. You think back, how long ago was that?
Well, that was, I graduated high school in 1989, so that was over 20 years ago. But it, you know, the memories of, you know, band and playing my trumpet, they're pretty powerful.
Yeah. And what position did you play on the sub-state championship basketball team?
I started out when I was in like junior high. I was a runt of my class, so I played point guard, and I handled the ball pretty well. And then I got really tough between my freshman and sophomore year. I had a growth spurt, and then I was a wing and a low post.
Wow.
So by the time we went to sub-state, it was my junior year, and I was down under the basket, throwing elbows and trying to score down there.
Nice. How tall are you?
I think I was taller. I swear I'm shrinking. I'm about a little over 5'8" now, but I know that on the sports program in high school it said 5'9". Now, of course, we could have been fudging that to intimidate the other team.
Yeah.
I think we all just kind of added an inch onto our height. I'm not sure.
It's interesting. When you talk about height with guys, they're very sensitive. Well, short guys. Remember, Tim, I had Chris Jericho on, and
oh yeah,
I started talking about his height, and all of a sudden he left the interview.
Yeah. Sorry, I got to go.
Really?
I have a pizza in the oven.
Well, first of all, who's Chris Jericho, and how tall is he really?
Well, Chris Jericho is a WWE wrestling star, and he was just on Dancing with the Stars. Heinz Ward beat him out in the final little thing there, and who was the gal from Cheers?
Christy Alley.
Christy Alley, right. Yeah. Anyway,
how tall is he? I gotta know.
Shelley, he's, what did he say, 5'8", and then somewhere else there was a 5'6" or 7", and then somewhere, I saw three different heights when I was doing the research on him. That's why I brought it up. You know,
that's
I'm interested in facts. Facts.
That's all. I need the facts.
Yeah.
Great.
Age 4, you wanted to be a country music singer. You know, most people, like, seriously, I don't have any childhood memories anywhere near that time period, age 4. But you knew you wanted to be a country music singer? Really?
I did, and I have childhood memories from, believe it or not, I know it sounds outlandish, but I really do have memories from around 2 years old. And, you know, not a lot of them, but
yeah.
I do have recollection where I would ask my folks when I got older, you know, tell me about the house where this was this and that was that. And they're like, you were 2. How do you remember that? But I declared at age 4, and it's on an audio tape somewhere, at Christmas, I think, of 1974, where my Aunt Char was going around with a little microphone and tape recorder asking all of us kids what we wanted to do when we grew up. And I grabbed the little microphone and said, I want to be a country music star. And that was true. That's all I ever wanted to be.
Just like Loretta Lynn or even Buck Owens, mm-hmm. I guess. Right?
Yeah, those were I really liked that traditional sound. Although I was a child of the 70s, where the kind of the urban cowboy music was about to hit, that more pop sound of country music, I was really early on drawn to Webb Pierce and Buck Owens, Hank Sr., Connie Smith, Wanda Jackson. And then, of course, once I got to Nashville in 1989, you know, my first record was very traditional. And then I really started to have those other musical influences seep in on me. And then I started to, my music tended to be a little bit more contemporary country, which suits me just fine. It's just that I had never been exposed to anything other than traditional country. So that was definitely my love growing up.
It's funny you mentioned Urban Cowboy. A good friend of mine was in that, Madeline Smith Osborne, and she lives in the Toronto area. And I don't think she likes anything to do with country music whatsoever. So on behalf of all of those kind of people, I apologize. I really do.
Well, you know, it was a movement. It was definitely a phenomenon.
Yeah, that's right.
And an exciting time in country music, I'm guessing, if, you know, I wasn't in the industry at that time. But, you know, we had another explosion in country music, the Garth Brooks era,
yeah,
in the late 90s, or late 80s and early 90s. And I, fortunately, as I detailed in my book, like me, I was able to be a part of that explosion of country music. And it became not just little, you know, mom and pop country music anymore. It became really kind of the popular music of our nation.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with a father who forced me to listen to that hurtin', whinin', you know, AM country music kind of thing. And I rebelled dead set against it. And then the new country thing came along. And, you know, I was in rodeo school, and I've dug more post holes and thrown more hay bales than anybody that I knew at that point in the country music who were singing about post holes and hay bales and horses and thinking, really, really, you're singing about this,
right,
but you're not living it? I don't get that. That was a disconnect for me. But now, man, the music.
Well,
just...
I don't know. There were a lot of people making country music that I know that really did grow up that way. I can think of a couple of what we would call posers.
Yeah.
But by and large, my contemporaries in country music really were country folk that made their way to Nashville and really did know how to ride horses and really did grow up doing chores on the farm. So I there were always a couple of posers. You are correct there. A couple of guys that you could tell they just put a cowboy hat on for the first time,
yeah,
to make their record.
Yeah.
Know?
The telltale sign for whether you're a poser or not is when you tuck your Wranglers into your boots. You know, just, I mean, that's not, come on.
That's not country,
no,
is it? What is that?
No, I don't know what that is.
Why would anyone do that?
Who does that? All right, tell us your God story. I mean, I know spiritually, I think you've known since your late teenage years that God and you were good. But how did you know that? How did you come to that understanding?
Well, I've never heard anyone say, tell me your God, but I think I know what you're talking about. I was raised in a small community in Kansas where, you know, it was conservative. I came to know God at a very young age, because that was the kind of household I was brought up in, and that's the language that was spoken in my household and in church where I went. And I actually, as I detail in my book as well, I detail my going to my mother and asking her if I could be baptized. I felt it was time for me, and I was a young kid of, you know, 6 years old, and that's usually, you know, younger than most people become baptized. But I understood what it meant, and I wanted. I had always had a relationship with God. I'd always felt like I was never alone. So I really, I obviously understood that I was gay by age 9. And of course, this terrified me because what I was hearing in church and the language, non-linguistic and linguistic, was that there was something wrong with me. Now, of course, I prayed every day for God to change me, fix me. This was a dedicated prayer that I did say every single day of my life.
Sometimes 20 times a day.
Sometimes 20 times a day. And, you know, I look back and it breaks my heart for the little 12-year-old me who was walking out into the middle of a horse pasture so I could say my prayer aloud. It breaks my heart that I should have been focusing on other things, and I was really, really suffering spiritual turmoil, deep spiritual turmoil. And I came in my late teenage years, I had understanding from God that I was exactly as I was supposed to be, and I didn't hear a voice speaking to me. I didn't have a dream that where God walked up to me and tapped me on the shoulder, but what it was me was that in churches I would be told of this God who would punish and this God who would condemn. And I do understand that sin is not without consequence. I do understand that it is my job as a Christian to do my best to do better. Hmm. But those things were about, in my mind, were about things that I could actually, that I had control over. Of course I shouldn't lie to my parents. Of course I shouldn't hit my sister in the head with a baseball bat. Of course I shouldn't gossip about other kids. And of course I shouldn't steal candy from the drugstore. Those were things that I had a power to make a decision of. But I also knew I knew that I was gay, and I knew it felt natural to me to be who I was. And so I had that God at church being told about, but I also had a God 7 days out of the week rather than just one day out of the week that seemed to be sitting next to me on a piano bench and that was giving me songs. If I climbed a tree, I felt that God was with me. If I was going to sleep, I felt that God was with me. So the God of love and truth for me really told me, you're okay. And I have always felt that. That being said, I did still know that I needed to hide because I knew I was in spiritual cultural jeopardy rather than spiritual jeopardy, and I knew I must hide my secret.
The coming out story, the interviews, et cetera. First of all, great interview with Natalie Morales, and it was really hard to decide which one to look at. You are both stunning, stunning women. I've just got to say that. Secondly, God, family, country, and gay. One of these things are, you know, just doesn't belong here, right? I've heard that since coming out in May 2010, I think, that your album sales dropped 50%. Is that about right or not?
More than that. Well, I had said that in an interview, and Billboard magazine actually ran an article and corrected me that my record sales had dropped to a third
of
what they had once been. So it dropped more than 50%.
Wow.
Thanks for noticing, Billboard.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Death threats?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. No, you did not get death threats.
Yeah. That happened, huh?
Mm-hmm. Man, I'm really sorry. Most people know that when you finally release a secret you've been keeping, especially one held back in shame, that the relief can be unbelievable. But the bigger the secret, I guess the greater the anxiety about releasing that secret, right? So take us back to the beginning, the very first person who knew. Who was that?
The first girl I ever kissed. I was 19 years old. And I lived in Nashville, and I worked at a theme park called Opryland USA. Great live country music show called Country Music USA and different shows in the park. I happened to be in the country show. And it was the job that took me to Nashville, and I developed a crush on a girl that she didn't work at Opryland, and we became girlfriends. And a week after that first kiss happened, I said homophobic things to the gay guys in my cast.
Yeah, you got all uppity and righteous to someone about them being gay. Like I don't want to see this, or keep it to yourself, or something like that?
I said, I don't care who you are. I don't mind what you do. Get out of my face. It's sinful. I don't want to see it. I was 19, but I was so afraid that those gay guys would be able to identify some behavior or characteristic in me, and I wanted to make sure that if they ever suspected it, they would refer back to the comments and realize that, oh, no, she's not gay. She said it's sick and sinful.
Right.
So I projected all kinds of negative things on them because I didn't want to be found out. So and it's the only time I did that, thank God.
How very Ted Haggard of you.
Right. Perfect, right? It was in perfect fashion of what we see today. You know, we're going to, time will tell. Time is writing its history, and we'll all look back in 20 or 30 years, and we'll see that so many of these folks who are working so hard to deny the gay and lesbian community of, civil liberties and rights and freedoms, we'll look back and we'll see that they were doing a lot of that to throw people off of their truth, and it's sad. And I in no way am not sympathetic to what they're going through. It's religious-based bigotry makes people do all kinds of crazy
yeah,
things.
Yeah, the hardest person to tell? Is that your dad?
My dad, yeah. That was really hard, yeah.
Now, is there not a story about you and your dad watching the show where Ellen came out?
Yeah. I told my dad in 2005 that I'm gay, and my nerves were really ratcheted up maybe 10 years prior to that, or maybe 8 years prior to that, whenever Ellen DeGeneres came out. I always knew that my dad was thought that gays were sick, and my dad's a country boy from the Midwest, and he thought it was sinful and deviant and wrong. And then the minute I thought maybe someday I might, you know, confide in my dad, that was quickly turned around by a comment he made to me the day Ellen came out. I happened to be home in Kansas for a funeral, and I stayed with my dad and my sister and I. And my dad stayed up and watched the Ellen DeGeneres show because we all thought she was funny, and my dad thought she was just a great comedian. And then she came out on her show that night as we watched TV, and my dad reached for the remote control, powered off the TV, and said, "That's disgusting." And that was in, you know, whatever year that was. I think it was 97, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really.
Scared me to death, and it made me recommit myself that I would never, ever come out, and that I would never let my father find this out about me. But cut to 2005, and I, perhaps I was growing up and becoming a wiser woman, but I was really appreciating how fleeting life is. And my dad called me, and he said, "Hon, is there something I've done wrong? We're not both like we used to be." He said, "Have I made you mad?" And it broke my heart that my dad was looking inside of himself to figure out why he and his kid weren't as close as they used to be. And I'd come out to my sister the year before. I realized I don't want my dad to have a heart attack and die and not know his kid.
Yeah.
So I told him, and I write about this in my book, and I think it's people's favorite chapter of the book. It certainly is mine. I told him in a little hotel room in Missouri right before one of my shows, and it was the love of a parent in action, and it was my dad was raised a Christian conservative guy that was raised to believe a lot of things, but he'll tell you, if you were on the phone right now, he'd tell you that everything he had learned back in Kansas and Missouri was wrong. The minute his kid said, "Dad, I'm gay," and he hugged me and he said, "It's okay." And I said, "Do you love me even though?" And he said, "Kid, I love you because." And that's, I'm really lucky to have that in my life.
Yeah, very lucky. Well, I mean, Ellen's dad and stepmother asked her to move out when she came out, I think because maybe the stepmother had two little girls and they didn't want them to be exposed to it. But her mom's book, you actually used to help your dad process his feelings when you came out, right?
I did. I had read her book prior to my telling my dad, and I remember reading, when Ellen came out, it did a lot of things internally for me. It inspired me, and it also scared me to death. It was just too, it made me so jealous and hurt, and it was like seeing another kid get a brand new shiny bike and knowing I was never going to have a shiny bike. It hurt. It hurt really bad to watch her. But then I read her mom's book, and that hurt me too, because I knew I'll never, ever have a parent like that. I'll never have a parent's love like that. So when I did come out, I gave my dad Love Ellen, Betty DeGeneres' book, and it was helpful. It was, again, my dad's reaction was as perfect as it could have been. But he's also educated himself a lot since I came out. Not only is it just okay with my dad that I'm gay, he celebrates it. He knows it's just a part of who I am. He knows nothing wrong. He knows that this was God's plan for me. God didn't make a mistake in me. You know, it hurts my dad that I hid. My dad is proud that I not only came out, but that I came out as a gay Christian, and that I talk about my walk with God, and that I that I've always lived life in, you know, in the fashion that I think God would best. When I have choices of to do wrong or to do right, when I'm able to make choices, and yes, I fail, but I do my best to correct those mistakes. But being gay is not anything I have a choice about.
We're chatting with Shelley Wright, of course, award-winning country recording artist. She's got that book out that a lot of people have been chatting about. I've heard a number of people mention it, like me. Well done with that one. Did John Rich, who we all now know a little better because of Celebrity Apprentice, I guess we also know Gary Busey a little better as well, did John Rich really say to you, you're not gay, are you? Because if you are, people won't have it. It's sick, it's deviant, it's unacceptable to country music fans. Did that really go down?
It did. I wrote it in my book. Everything in my book is 100% true, and I did write that, and it happened in the timeline. It happened in the timeline that I said it did. Although after my book came out, John did a press release with a statement that was kind of skewed a timeline a little bit, and I understand why he did it. He wanted folks to think that. What he said was, no, the reason I said thank God was because I was trying to get a date with her. But the date that he actually, the timeline in which he said that to me was in 2005. And because he couldn't claim that he said it was trying to get a date with me then, because he was actually with his now wife in a relationship, he tried to scoot it back 5 years, so which didn't happen because the studio parking lot where we were wasn't even in existence. So he changed the timeline a little bit to try to, you know, who wants to admit they're a bigot? Who wants to admit that they got caught being a bigot? And you know, it happened. And the thing is, John is not alone in conservative communities of cornering people and saying, you know, you're not gay, are you? Because it's sick and deviant.
Yeah.
It just so happened that I wrote about it and he got caught. And that's probably pretty embarrassing for him.
Man, I'm just thinking about all the dumb, stupid things I've said over the years and how many books they're going to be in.
It happens. It happens.
Oh,
you know, but I'm not angry with John Rich. I've got a lot of bigger fish to fry than getting a spinning match with John. I don't wish him harm or anything. But we've been friends since Opryland. We've been friends since I was 18 years old and he was 17. It's, you know, I like to focus on the positives that are happening through my coming out, and that is sharing my story and making sure, you know, little 15-year-old kids in Topeka, Kansas know that their mom and dad's favorite country singer is like them, and that they can be gay and Christian and you know, upstanding citizens and never touch drugs and go to school and just be, you know, they're going to be okay.
Mm. What are some mistakes, Shelley, that you've seen people make when they've come out? And obviously, we're not going to associate any names with them, but, you know, is there a handbook on coming out? You know, has somebody come up with the ABCs of coming out?
You know, it's very different for everyone. The thing that is the commonality in coming out is that you can only do it when you're ready, and that it's the most amazing feeling. You just won't believe it when you the before and the after. It just makes a person feel whole. And I don't know that there's a right way to do it or a wrong way to do it. I do know that it everything in my life is now in color, and I think I was living a life in black and white before. I breathe deeper, I sleep better, I laugh louder. I see what all the fuss is about. I see why straight people like to hold the hand of their loved one and stand up in front of a congregation and a justice of the peace and say, this is the person I'm going to love forever, you know.
And you're planning on doing that next month, are you not? Or maybe not, in August.
Yeah, August 20th. And last night, the marriage equality in New York State was passed. And so, you know, Lauren and I, you know, having a lot of discussions today about making ourselves leap here in New York State as well, and perhaps first. So we might sneak off to the courthouse there in Manhattan and tie the knot before our actual religious ceremony. Lauren is Jewish, and I'm a Christian, and we'll be having a reverend and a rabbi perform our ceremony in Connecticut, but looks like we'll be legally wed in New York State prior to that.
Boy, you're just ticking off all the Jesus people and all the strokes. And you're gay, you're Christian, you're marrying a Jew. I mean, what else can you do?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Well, let's see. I could go make a pop record.
Oh, maybe you could call it Friday. Yeah.
Right. You know what, though? To answer your question about have seen anyone do it wrong,
yeah,
coming out wrong,
yeah,
I don't think so. I think truth wins. And, you know, I've seen some people come out and say, okay, I'm gay. Now I don't want to talk about it. And I don't judge that harshly either. Some people want to do advocacy work. Some people don't. It was my goal. Why I was so strategic in my coming out and had such an amazing publicist and agents and record label and Random House. We all made that this was, we achieved a proper forum for my story to be heard. But, you know, I wanted to come out for me, first of all, but I wanted to be an advocate, and I'm doing that. But for some people, they just want to say, I'm gay, leave me alone, let me have my privacy and get back to my life. And that's good, too.
All right, I don't want to dwell on this moment too long because, to be honest, this is the one that gets me a little emotional. But what the heck went on during that day you jammed the 9mm in your mouth? I guess that's about 5 years ago now. And you know, why didn't you pull the trigger?
I can't tell you why, but I can tell you what happened that morning. It was maybe clock in the morning, and it was so cold that winter, and I have a big beautiful house in East Nashville, and it, you know, those old houses where it's colder inside than it is outside.
Yeah, that's called Canada.
Oh, that's right. I'm preaching to the choir here. That's what it was like in my house, and I'd been in my pajamas for, you know, a good 6 weeks, and I couldn't stop crying. I literally cried every day nonstop, and I found myself hopeless for the first time in my life. And mind you, I'm one of the more hopeful people that I know. I'm the little girl from Kansas who had big dreams and made those dreams come true. I've never had anything in my life I didn't think I could achieve. So I found myself hopeless. I had lost the partner that I had had for 12 years. We lived that entire relationship in secret. And boy, that'll take a toll.
Hmm.
It ripped us apart. I'd lost that. And I realized I'm walking around in this beautiful house with financial security and career success, and nobody knows me. I had a broken heart and couldn't even talk to my best friends because they didn't even know I had a broken heart, because they didn't even know I'd ever had a relationship. I had created a life where nobody knew me. And I just didn't know. I knew I couldn't come out. You can't tell the country music world who you are and that you've been essentially lying to them all along. Couldn't do that. And I realized it would be best if I just passed, if I just didn't live anymore, and then it would be over. The pain would be over. So I have a 9mm gun, and I went upstairs and took it out, and I went back down to the foyer of my house. I have a beautiful 1909 house there, and it's got five fireplaces in it. And in the mantles of the fireplace, there are these beautiful beveled mirrors. And I was looking at myself in this mantle fireplace mirror. I put the gun in my mouth, and I couldn't believe what it looked like. You know, it doesn't look like what you think it looks like. And a 9mm gun is bigger in your mouth than you would imagine, and it's colder, and the gun is heavier than you would imagine, and you just don't look like yourself with a gun in your mouth. So I said a prayer to God to forgive me for what I was about to do, and I had a lot of my life flash before my eyes, much like, you know, you hear people talk about they're about to die, they see their life flash before their eyes, and that did happen for me. I saw my family and my pets and thought of music, and I thought of love lost, and I thought of sunshine. I was so cold, and I thought of how great it would feel to be warm. And I also had a thought of, why am I not crying? Don't people cry when they kill themselves? Shouldn't I be sobbing? And my eyes as big as saucers. And then all of a sudden I heard a pounding. Thump, thump, thump. And it wasn't the gun. It was my heartbeat pounding in my head. And then I watched as the vision of myself in this mirror became very blurry. And it was because I had started to cry. My tears, my eyes filled up, and then they just ran down my face. And I don't know why I didn't pull the trigger, but I took, something broke, the dam broke, and I took the gun out of my mouth, put it on the mantle, and I went all the way up to the third floor of my house. I got in bed and fell asleep. In the morning when I awakened, I was terrified to go back downstairs because I wasn't sure I wouldn't do it. I wasn't sure I wouldn't pick it up and do it. So I got on my knees, literally got on my knees by my bed, put my elbows up on the edge of my bed, clasped my hands together, and changed the prayer that I'd been saying for so long. For so long I'd prayed, dear God, but help me hide and keep my secret and still have success and blah, blah, blah. I said, dear God, give me a moment's peace. And in your name I pray, amen. And the minute I said amen, I knew that I had received peace. I felt it. I felt warm. I felt, okay, I'm going to be okay today. The message that I got was, again, I didn't hear a booming voice of God, but the message I got was, okay, stop doing it your way. Do it my way. And the way that I felt God had been whispering in my ear for a long, long time. Those decisions about the things you have control over, I had control over the why. I didn't have control over, you know, my sexuality was. I had control over the lie and the trap, the trappings of the lie. And the message I got that day was, you're going to come out. And don't, it didn't scare me, but it also brought me a lot of comfort to know that the fight was over. Now I just had to lean on my faith and come out.
Long, awkward silence. Shelley, my reaction with you, being a gay Christian woman, or I don't know, whatever the terms, I always get in trouble by my friends who are working to sort of bridge the gap between the church and the gay community because I never use the right words or language. But my reaction to you has been the warmest of any coming out story that I've heard in the 8 years of doing this show. And I'm trying to figure out why. So just humor me for a second. Just work with me on this. Is it because you're a woman? Because I think straight guys have a harder time with gay guys than they do with lesbians. For I don't know, whatever the deal is. There's some Freudian thing or something. Or Kinsey. Is it because you're not just a woman, but you're like, in my books, you know, there's women, you know, Wendy, you know where I'm going with this. Wendy's sitting beside me already laughing. You are just ridiculously gorgeous. And, I'm, you know, superficial male. I don't know. Maybe that's part of it as well. But the thing that I keep coming back to is saying this prayer since grade three, please God, please don't let me be gay. I promise to be a good person. Wellsville, Kansas, small town, what, 12 to 1400 people, right? I mean, it's not like you're some rebellious little city girl trying to be all that and trying to fit in or whatever. You've been praying this contrite, broken, submitted prayer for so many years, and then this suicide gun thing, and then this brokenness again. I think it has to do more with the authenticity of the journey of pain that you've been through. And the surrender, you seem to have this continuous theme of surrender in your life. So I don't know. I cannot figure it out. It has to do with all that stuff, I guess. You know, would it be different if you were a guy? Would it be different if you were someone I didn't consider to be smoking hot? I'm going to put my foot into it here. Would it be different if I didn't know this much of a backstory to it? It's just you've almost changed my brain on this whole thing.
Well, that's a blessing from God, I believe. And you know, you bring up a lot of really poignant elements to the discussion. let me start to address some of the questions. Would it be different if I were a guy? You know, it's perhaps there's something that seems to be a bit more benign or palatable about the Freudian. There's a deep psychological issue that a lot of people have with gay men, and I think the AIDS crisis factors into it. I think pedophilia factors into it, although pedophilia and homosexuality have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with it. However, there are these myths woven into these discussions of religious bigotry convince people that gay men want to sleep with little boys. You know, it's pretty complex. So you bring up a lot of topics that, you know, I can't speak. I'm not an authority on anyone's story but my own. I will tell you, as far as the fact that I appreciate the compliment about my good looks, as you say, I appreciate that. I think that part of I felt I could come out and be effective because I felt that I was uniquely positioned to challenge stereotypes. And
yeah.
And this is why I made the decision, because I am a Kansas farm girl who was the first to go into Iraq and play and sing for the troops in 2003, and I've been back 7 times. I am, very conservative in a lot of ways, in that I've never done a drug, never smoked a cigarette. I seldom have a glass of alcohol. And that's no judgment on those who drink or do whatever it is they do.
That's no judgment on me, is what you're saying.
It's right. I know that a lot of middle America thinks that gay women want to be men. I know there's a belief that, well, they're really masculine and they just they want to control. They hate men. To the contrary, my life is an example of evidence that that's not the case. And I feel that perhaps if you've been at all, maybe the door has opened a little bit for you to imagine people like me, more than any other coming out story that you've heard in a while. Perhaps it's because I repeatedly challenge stereotypes, and that's exactly why I got myself really together, got my team position myself, gay, Christian, feminine, salt of the earth, farm girl, you know, lesbian.
Yeah.
And the surrender is important. I love that you mentioned that, because the minute I decided to come out, the minute I knew that's what was going to happen for me, my life became, I'm not going to exaggerate, my life became magical. My life became so much easier, and I've had a charmed life, I really have, but my life just became so much easier.
And you're very easy to talk to as well. Thank you very much. Well, boy, that time is just flown right out the window. I want to finish this interview. There's so much more we could talk about, and I'm apologizing for going long, but I'm also apologizing that we didn't have the time to cover a lot of other things. But can you just finish this with the most concise version you've ever told of the intervention attempted by those at your record label? Because that is a killer story, and we're going to play that clip of that song. I don't know if your label wants us to play this clip or not, but it floored me. I needed to pend undergarments listening to this song. It was classic. So.
Oh gosh, you know, when I was at my really rock bottom, the good thing is that it was a very prolific time for me in writing, and I wrote a lot of very sad songs. So each day at my house in Nashville, I would write a little song, record it with my MacBook, and I'd send the MP3, the little audio version, to my record label. And every day someone would respond back, "Hey, great, Shelley, love it, love the lyrics, a nice melody, keep writing." And after about the 9th song, they didn't respond one day to a song I'd sent in the morning. And at about 5 p.m., I got a phone call from the label, and I picked up, and I said, "Hey, did you guys get that song I sent?" And they said, "Yeah, that's what we're calling about." They said, "You're on a conference call. Is that okay?" And I said, "Okay." And about 12 of them were around the phone, and they said, "You know, we wanted to talk about the song. It's sad." They're all sad. They said, "We think you should write something positive and hopeful." And I said, "Well, I appreciate your input, but that's not really what I'm feeling." And they said, "No, seriously, if you don't write something positive and hopeful, we're going to have to put a warning sticker on your album so people don't kill themselves. It's a depressing record. So I hung up the phone and got out a clean sheet of paper and got my guitar, and I wrote a little song.
A little song, which we are about to play here on The Drew Marshall Show. Shelley Wright, you are the bomb. That's what all the kids say these days. You're the bomb. Shelley.com, and it's spelled the weird way, C-H-E-L-Y. That's just in case you're wondering how, you know, if you can find her online. Shelley Wright, you got to get your backside up to Canada and do some kind of gig up here, will you? You are more than welcome.
I love it.
And
I absolutely love Canadian audiences. They're amazing. And find me on Twitter, Shelley Wright on Twitter. And I want to get back up there. I'd love it. It was good talking to you. I
appreciate your guts and your heart and your time, Shelley. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Shelley Wright on The Drew Marshall Show. Have a listen to this classic wee tune that she wrote as a result of that story.